This week, we're joined by Toby, Will and Ricky for our biggest pod yet. We'll look over all the action from round four of the Guinness Six Nations, where Italy pulled off a famous win in Rome against Scotland. England got a monumental W against Ireland and crushed their Grand Slam hopes. And Wales are still struggling with a loss against France. So let's start with Italy versus Scotland. It was Italy's first home Six Nations win for 11 years, their last being Ireland in 2013, and their first win against Scotland since 2015. What did you think of the game, boys?
Oh, look, it's an absolutely monumental win for Italy, isn't it? They've shown good promise over the last couple of Six Nations, and especially this year after those quite damaging defeats against New Zealand and France in the World Cup. You know, I was really hoping that Italy would be able to reinvigorate themselves for this Six Nations, and oh boy, have they reinvigorated themselves. They're in absolutely scintillating form on Saturday at a packed out Stadio Olimpico, and yeah, I was just glad to see them win. I'm not sure about you boys, but it was just nice to see Italy get a win on the board. That the Rome crowd could finally see their country win on home turf. It was just a nice, wholesome feeling.
Did look like a special day, especially we saw with Lewis Leiner at the end, who was saying that his dad in the stands, obviously Australia legend Michael, was close to tears, if not in tears, at the full-time whistle, seeing his boy score his try on his debut. He's a special player that seems to be like one that's got away for England. What did you make of his performance, Ricky?
Well, I thought he played incredibly well. I think his performance kind of summed up the Italian performance as well. It's full of gusto, it's full of grit, and it was just, you know, really classy performance. I think the Italian team is really exciting. I look forward to the next weekend. It's just going to be incredible, isn't it?
Absolutely. And also, we have to mention it was quite a close game in the first half, actually. Obviously, going into the second half, Leiner's try really sort of set the tone, changed the momentum. But really, that first half, both Scotland props getting on the board, that was something that you really saw.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, as you mentioned, yeah, that Lewis Leiner try really seemed to kickstart Italy. I mean, they've started playing well, of course, from the get-go. But I mean, I think you also have to remember the Scottish try that was overturned. They didn't score a point after that, after the 28th minute, other than the final try that Scotland scored to bring them right back into it. They didn't score a single point, which is absolutely mental that they went effectively, 50 minutes, 40 minutes without really threatening Italy. Which, I mean, you look at the beginning of the tournament and Italy played well. I mean, they played really well against England, played less well against a very strong Ireland side, but they seemingly have improved every single week. And I mean, with a new coach in Casada, it's been really exciting to see that they've managed to find some form that they started to build a few years ago before what was a really poor World Cup in the end for them. And the fact that Scotland seemingly are now crumbling. They yet again started the tournament fairly strong. That first 40 minutes against Wales were unbelievable. And then since then, they just seemingly have struggled a lot more. Got quite a crucial win against England a couple of weeks ago now. But that was basically a Doan van der Merwe masterclass that seemingly carried them through. And yeah, they just didn't really seem to have anything within them on the weekend that really sort of, considering where they were at just a few months ago, the fifth best team in the world, and probably would have been semi-finalists or quarter-finalists had they had a better draw at the World Cup. The fact that now they're losing to Italy, who are now in the top 10 of the world rankings. The fact that they are losing to what is a good Italy side, but not one that they should be losing to, really sums up the strife that they're in at the moment.
Definitely. You said that they're back in the top 10. Actually, they're up in ninth now. They're ahead of Australia, which is incredible to see. One thing I did really notice was, particularly after Scotland's last try, under the post in the 77th minute, Italy's defence right at the end. That's something that we'd never normally see with an Italian side. Normally, they drop off around the 60th minute. But we're really seeing an Italian side that can go that for later. I think that is the key difference, that and the fact that they've evolved their kicking game, where before they're always trying to run it out, now they're actually looking at playing that tactical kicking, whether it's attacking, whether it's defensive. We saw two of their tries the Juan Ignacio Brex try and the Lewis Leiner try, just brilliant chips over the top, just finding that space. One player I did really want to talk about, and this one I'm sure Will's got some comments about, is a boy from Carmarthen, Stephen Varney. Is he one that's got away for Wales?
Nah, look, so Stephen Varney, yeah, originally from Carmarthen, just down the road from where I grew up myself, and he's got a proud Welsh-Italian heritage. And yet he ended up playing for Italy. Of course, he's based down in Gloucester at the moment. And nah, I can't say he's one that got away for Wales. I mean, Wales themselves have a rich history of great nines, really. From Mike Phillips to Gareth Davis in recent years. And look, Stephen Varney's playing for Italy now, and he's not quite made the nine shirt his own. He came off the bench, of course, on Saturday, but he scored that all important try to put Italy 28-22 ahead late on there in the game. But yeah, just one thing I wanted to touch on as well was sort of Scotland's ill discipline during that second half. I think there was 8 penalties that went against Scotland in a row, and that really just sums up their second half performance. Really, it was one without any real discipline whatsoever. You know, they're just coming off a massive victory against England in the Calcutta Cup the week before, and to follow that up with that sloppy performance, in all honesty. Of course, yeah, Italy had their moments too, and they were superb in the second half especially. But yeah, I just didn't see much sort of on-field leadership from any of those Scottish senior players that would have really dragged them through there in the second 40.
No, I definitely agree. I think the old adage, the old saying that you never know which France side's going to show up, I think that's almost starting to apply to Scotland now. Whereas France, they've been a bit rusty this Six Nations, but where they've been very solid and very predictable almost, you know that they're going to put out at least a good performance. Scotland, as we've seen, they played probably their best performance that they've played for a very long time against England. And then suddenly they're falling to Italy. No disrespect to Italy, but as a team ranked that wants to be ranked in the top five, that's a match you have to win. And I think, yeah, it's just incredible to see how Italy have now become almost a very much more solid side. And while Scotland, you just, they're not quite there. Ricky?
Yeah, can we just swing back to the fact that Italy were one kick away from having two wins in this Six Nations tournament, which, like, it would be phenomenal, wouldn't it? Like, this Italian team is really, really talented. And if it weren't for, well, some very questionable refereeing, they could have had two wins.
Absolutely. It's, yeah, an Italian side. If you could say 5 years ago, an Italian side's going to have two wins in the Six Nations, maybe even three. We don't know what's going to happen against Wales. We'll obviously get onto that later. But a team that can, at the very least, be in contention for three wins. Who would have thought that 5 years ago, especially 10 years ago? It's incredible to see. So now on to England versus Ireland. I can obviously talk about this match all day, getting to see England beat, I'm not going to say the best side in the world, because Ireland didn't win the World Cup, but definitely one of the top sides. Getting to see England play like that, get Twickenham rocking. I heard accounts that actually it felt like, if you were in the stadium, it felt like there was almost an earthquake going on. The stadium was shaking that much at full time. I could talk about it all day. I'm sure Ricky could talk about it all day. Not sure Absolutely. You could, Will. So 23-22. We all know about the drop goal at the end. But I think what really set the tone was Tommy Freeman at the very start. That hit, him taking the contact against Calvin Nash. Calvin Nash obviously, unfortunately, going off with a failed head injury assessment. But then that just setting up Ollie Lawrence in the corner. England meant business. And it was giving echoes of a few years ago against Ireland in Dublin, that game where Manu Tuilagi and Henry Slade teed up so perfectly in centres. What were your thoughts, Ricky?
Well, I think it's all about start as you mean to go on. If you start with that intensity, that passion, that fire, you know, it's going to carry throughout the game. And that's what we saw. We saw a different England. We saw a Borthwick side that really wanted to attack the ball. And that, like, I know we conceded the penalty first, but then we made that statement of intent. And then we went on from there, and arguably we were the better team. Ireland obviously did what they do best. They stayed within the game. They didn't play well at all, but they stayed within reach. And, well, we know how it ended, don't we?
We certainly do. The thing that I thought was really quite interesting, there's been a lot of debate around it, is George Ford's kicking. Because there's a lot of people saying that they didn't feel that George Ford had a great game. I personally thought he had a very good game if it weren't for his kicking. But you can't be missing that many kicks on such big occasion. What were your thoughts, Toby?
Yeah, no, I think it's a harsh one. I mean, he missed one pretty bad one in front of the posts, but what, another two a bit further out wide? It's tough in some ways. Like, you're not always going to be perfect as a professional rugby player. And I think the rest of his game was very good. I mean, he didn't make many mistakes, and was pretty crucial to a couple of the tries, particularly when they were sort of overloading down the blind side. I think I'm right in saying for Ollie Lawrence's try. And I mean, I think it probably didn't help that Marcus Smith came in and did make a few crucial kicks. I still think that actually it probably wasn't the smartest move by Smith to try and to take the drop goal. I think it's a bit maybe a bit sort of pedantic from me, and a bit sort of trying to find the poor form where I can. But the fact that England probably needed a bonus point, they're still bonus pointless in the tournament, and it means that they really now, Ireland, have to lose and lose quite convincingly this weekend to Scotland, which seems quite unlikely if you go off Scottish form. Whereas England, with an extra bonus point, they'd only be 3 points behind. They'd have a possibility of actually winning the whole tournament if things went their way a bit, and particularly when they had the penalty advantage. That maybe Smith wanted a bit of glory for himself. Who knows? I think it's probably more he wanted just to take victory and claim it right there. But I think the fact that he came on and actually, well, first of all, drop goal conversion, first of all, and then the drop goal, I think probably highlighted the fact that George Ford did miss those couple kicks, which could have been crucial when it came down to the end of it.
I think that is a really interesting question. Do you, in that situation, do you go for the drop goal, or when you're that close to the line, do you go for the try? When I saw someone say actually over the weekend he was stupid to go for the drop goal, he should have just gone for the try, but I'm not sure I agree. You had penalty advantage, just go for the points. England were going for the win. There's no guarantee, if you're, at least in my opinion, there's no guarantee you're going to get the try, and there is a risk that if you pass out to the wings, you're going to lose the advantage. So there is that risk that you could end up losing out. And again, there's no guarantee that you're going to score the penalty either, as we saw with George Ford earlier in the game. So if you can take two opportunities to just get the points and get the win, I think in that situation, you've just got to go for it. England not getting bonus points is a bit of a concern, but if you're getting wins, that's the most important thing, I think, especially against a team like Ireland. You just have to take it where you can. Another player that I think it's divided opinion has been George Fairbank. Now, I will go on the record and I will say I'm not the biggest fan of him at international level. I think he's a good player, and I understand what England are trying to do. They're trying to almost make him into this like Blair Kinghorn-esque 15. But I do think Stewart is the stronger 15 option. But at the same time, you've got to blood these players. And if you have a player like George Fairbank that could be that second choice, you have to go for it. What are your thoughts, Will?
Yeah, I mean, what we saw was Fairbank really integrate quite well into that back three. And I'm seeing Ricky shaking his head here, but at the end of the day, England won. And that's what you can't forget. I know Ireland weren't on the best of form, but England won, and that included Fairbank playing at 15. Since Stewart's got dropped, obviously, Fairbank's come in, and he's lost against Scotland, won against Ireland now, and evidently it's a decision that the coaching staff have taken, that they want Fairbank at 15. I've always liked watching Stewart under the high ball. I think he's quite prolific in that sense. Always really thought, yeah, he was one of the best fullbacks at taking those high balls. But Fyrbaktens, he brings a different dimension to that England attack. And that really shone through, I think, against Ireland. And it really did cause their defence some problems, especially on the overlap.
Yep.
I think it's quite an interesting call there between the two of them. I think considering Stewart was probably the number one, or has been the number one fullback for at least a couple of years now, and has been very, very good back there. He's obviously a very different kind of player to Furbank. So I think it is good to see from an England perspective that George Furbank is getting a chance, because you do need to find out if he's going to be good enough. And I mean, I think it's likely that in 4 years' time, when the big games come around again, that you'll pick Furbank for some games, you pick Stewart for others, and you might even pick them both at points if you really need to. And who knows, Marcus Smith can always play back there again when needed. And I think that having different options is absolutely crucial for winning major competitions. And I get that England have talked a lot about the fact that they're in a sort of transitional period. Whether they are or not is a different question on itself. But the fact that they're at least trying out different players in different positions, they know what Stewart's like. They know he's a very, very good player. They know he can handle himself at fullback if they need him to. But finding out different players and different skill sets and who can work when and against different oppositions, I think is almost as important as sort of selecting your strongest 15 every single game, because you'll get to a stage where you know your 15 best players, but who you're bringing out, who, what happens if there's an injury, what happens if someone's completely out of form by the time a tournament rolls around. So I think you do have to try and mix and match a little bit in these early years of a new cycle.
I completely agree. I think the great thing with Stewart and Furbank is they almost complement each other in the way that they're so different. We've seen George Furbank step in at the last minute a few years ago against Tonga, playing fly half actually for that match, replacing Marcus Smith. Where Stewart is fantastic under the high ball, he's fantastic defensively. He's a good player in attack, but he's fantastic in defence. It's almost the opposite with George Furbank. And I think that's what's really interesting. And come a World Cup, you could have matches where actually, do you want to prioritise attack or do you want to prioritise defence? And that's who you'd end up selecting on. And England have experimented with who this second choice fullback is for a long time. We've had George Furbank in and around the squad for a long time. There's a reason coaches love him. He's been fantastic all season. He's been captaining Northampton at times, which is incredible to see from fullback as well. But we've had Max Malins at 15. We've had other players try to take that position and it's never quite worked. Obviously, Max Malins isn't even in the squad anymore. Will?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention before we move on how absolutely ridiculous Ben Earl was.
Oh, absolutely. That's what
on Saturday.
To.
You know, a man of the match performance by far. He was the best player on the field, and I think he's been England's best player for the Six Nations. You know, just he's absolutely revitalized that England back line. You've had players like, you know, Billy Vunipola over the years, very different number eight to what Ben Earl is. He's a combative number eight and he's very strong at carrying that ball, and he's really shone through, I've got to say, in the Six Nations so far. And yeah, by far the best player on the field again on Saturday.
Yeah, I think it was really nice to see, talking about the pack as well, that England seemed to have it really well balanced. Having Chesham at six, I think, is possibly the way they're going to look to go forward, because he does offer so much more. He's a massive guy. He's a good ball carrier. When you compare that to Ben Earl, who is a very good ball carrier, but doesn't quite have the size maybe, and Underhill, who is defensively brilliant, I think they quite nicely all kind of complement each other. And I mean, obviously, Courtney Laws had that role for a few years previously. He's now retired. I think Chesham or Itoje or Martin, whoever it might be, the fact that they can have sort of three massive units on the pitch together at the same time, I think is absolutely crucial. It's what the French have had and the South Africans have had, and even the Kiwis a bit. Every single top team almost always has some huge ball carriers, because you need those guys to really get your momentum going when everything else is going wrong. If you can't spin out of the back, you see when South Africa, it's going wrong for them. They will just crash ball it like what phase after phase after phase, because they know it'll get them going, and then eventually they'll chuck up a high kick, or they'll spin it wide to Chesney Colby, whoever it might be, and something will happen because the defense has been ground down so long. If you haven't got that size within a team, you often don't have the ability to try and suck defenders in from out wide, and therefore you don't have any space, because you know you don't need as many defenders around the fringes if they haven't got the strong ball carriers, and you can just sort of man on man mark them up and do sort of single tackles and just chop them down and even make dominant hits on your own. I think it's absolutely massive to have massive guys in the side.
Absolutely. I think, well, I don't know whether you'd have noticed this, but actually defensively, Bernal was playing blindside flanker, and actually Ollie Chesham was stepping in at number eight, which was really strange to see, seeing Ollie Chesham playing number eight. But I think having that almost five and a half role, as has been talked up in the past, that where Courtney Laws has operated, where Ollie Chesham's perfect, where Chandler Cunningham South has really proven his worth off the bench, I think that's somewhere that England has really highlighted, where in 2019 there was the kamikaze twins of Sam Underhill and and Tom Curry. It's clear that they want to move away from that. I'm not completely sold at Ben Earl as number eight, but I think that's more my love for Alex Dunbrant more than anything. But no, absolutely, that there's so much balance to the back row that England just haven't had for so long. And it's so good to see. And I love the fact that, as a bit of a line-out nose myself, having three proper line-out options. Also, Sam Underhill, I don't know if any of you saw that, his take at the end, that line-out, it was just so good. I actually saw his dad tweeting about it, like sharing tweets, just saying how good Sam Underhill was, just being his little hype man. It was so good to see.
But before you get too carried away there, Henry, let's just go back to Ben Earl there for a second. He's made 17 more carries than the second place position in the Six Nations. He's made 62, with Caelan Doris behind on 45. That, you know, that is just astronomical in comparison to the rest of the Six Nations players to be that far ahead. And he's also made the second most amount of meters during the Six Nations as well. So he's a player that's almost made, be it eight or at flanker, he's made that back row position his own. And I can really see England sticking with him now, well, at least for the next couple of years, especially with this form that he's got at the moment.
Been crazy to see just how there were so many calls years ago when Eddie Jones was in charge to play Ben Earl, and he'd given him a little opportunity, but he'd never really come to fruition. And now he has just taken his chance with both hands. We've seen it with Zach Mercer, where he almost had the opportunity, but whatever it was, whether he didn't fit in with the squad culture, whatever it was, whereas Ben Earl he's certainly taken it with both hands, and I'm all there for it. One last thing that I did want to touch on with this game, actually, which I'm sure you loved, Will, was the little exchange at half-time between Andy Farrell and Steve Borthwick as they're heading down the tunnel. What did you make of that?
Just two northern lads having a good little pop with each other. I'm sure they'd have had a good laugh about it after the match. But, yeah, I mean, I'm just interested to hear what you boys think, actually, about Steve Borthwick and the way that he's conducted himself this Six Nations. Are you pleased with the progression that England have made, arguably, in this Six Nations?
For me, Steve Borthwick has shown that he is able to change. And for me, I think that's the most important thing, because everyone's thought that he's very defensive. He doesn't want to play progressive rugby. And suddenly we see this game against Ireland where we've come straight out the starting blocks, and it's so refreshing to see. And it's also bright for the future, you know?
I definitely agree. I think there was a lot of criticism, particularly going into the World Cup, that it was too defensive. It was almost too compact. And I didn't agree at the time. I very much thought, and I still think, that his game plan was very much built around just get through the World Cup and then we start afresh. I think we've really seen that now. I think he's a very analytical coach. He really thinks through everything he does. And he's been building up to this big game. And we saw it as and actually Wibble Rugby mentioned in his latest video. He, a fantastic video as well, where he broke down Steve Borthwick's game plan and where England heading, and he got a bit of stick for it. A lot of people saying it's a great video, but got a little bit of a stick saying, where is England actually going? But that's really showed this weekend he couldn't have released it at a better time. But I think he took a bit of time to settle in at Leicester, but he sort of used the first few games as little throwaway ones, work out where to improve and everything. I think that's something we've really seen this Six Nations is it's taken a little bit of time to step it. It's taken a little bit of time for it to almost seep in. But now that it's starting to, we're really getting good results out of it, and it's really promising, I think. And finally, on to Wales versus France. That was, again, a game of two halves, as it always seems to be for Wales now. It started off fairly back and forth, really end-to-end, and then the second half of the second half, it really just opened up for France. Obviously, with our two resident Welshmen, with Will and with Toby, what did you both think of Wales's performance this weekend?
Look, I was impressed, to be honest with you, for the first 65 minutes. I was really pleased with the way that Wales were playing. 24-23 up going into the last 15 minutes. I was feeling quite hopeful, to be honest with you. I thought we'd put on a really good display of rugby against the French side, who had made 8 changes on the day, but due to the depth of their squad and the player base that they've got, making 8 changes isn't, in fact, that big of a deal for France at the moment. But I was pleased with the way that we played, and I am pleased with the progression that we've made this Six Nations. You know, we're missing some real heavy hitters in the side, from Dewi Lake at hooker, Jack Morgan, Faletau, Gareth Anscombe at 10. Of course, now he's back at Gloucester, he's going to be eligible again. And, you know, George North wasn't playing, Liam Williams. We are missing a lot of players who would more than likely slide right into the side. So, yeah, I was pleased that we could push France that far into the second half. In the end, I think the constant slogging away at, you know, 130, 140 kg players, you know, your Antonios, Boudons, and especially the strength that France could bring off the bench. Again, you know, Taofi Fenway, absolutely giant blokes coming off the bench, fresh legged for the last 20 minutes of play. And I think that really told in the end. But yeah, of course, the results haven't gone our way so far, but the progression is clear to see, in my opinion.
I think especially in open play, we're really seeing that with Wales. Like the Rio Dyer try, just cutting through the middle, that was incredible to see. What did you think of the game, Toby?
Yeah, no, I think Will got it bang on there. I only watched the first half, actually, because I was recording a different podcast about half time. But first half, I was really happy with it. I thought Wales played really well. And I think, as Will mentioned, there was just a big difference of strength and depth, basically, and size of that depth as well. We, as Will mentioned, there are a lot of injuries within this Welsh side, considering your sort of two co-captains from the World Cup just a few months ago aren't even involved in any of the Six Nations at the moment. I think really would have a massive effect. And yeah, I thought it was a slightly odd selection that there was no Tompkins or George North. It'd be interesting to know what sort of Gatland's thoughts about that were, whether it was to try and blood new young guys back into the squad, or whether he thought they were the better options, which they very well might have been. But yeah, I think the fact that Wales didn't have that size to really compete as the game went on and on and on, I think really was just that difference, that you are basically having to defend three or four 150, 140 kg guys who will just run nonstop, and then they'll be replaced by more 140, 150 kg guys, which Wales are almost never going to be able to compete with. There aren't really any of the Welsh players who are that size. So I think it's something that Wales will have to try and develop over the next 4 years, which we know Gatland has the ability to develop with teams like this. Wales have never had the biggest players and have never had the biggest player pool in any sort of competition, really. They've obviously performed well above their weight throughout that time, And I think you can even just looking at the sort of the stats over this time, you can see where Gatland's wanting to try and change it and defend, like in the way that Daffa Jenkins and Tommy Raphael are making so many tackles. They're the second and third highest tackle makers in the tournament so far. They also, I think, hit the most rucks as well. Yeah, Daffa Jenkins has the highest attacking ruck arrivals and Tommy Raphael has the highest defensive ones. So I think that in itself just shows how Warren Gatland wants to continue to play with this Welsh side.
Yeah, and as you mentioned there, Toby, Dav Jenkins made 26 tackles on Sunday, more than any other player by far. But it was really the amount of missed tackles that really hurt Wales in the end. We've mentioned the brute force of that French pack, and it really paid dividends in the last 20 minutes. But yeah, Dav Jenkins' first game in that number six role, I thought he slid right in there quite naturally. You know, he really has been a maverick of a player, this Six Nations. And I'm really pleased to see the way that he's developed with the captaincy armband around his arm too. I am very happy with the way that he's led the team. Nevertheless, there are still gaping holes in that Welsh side that are hurting us. This time round, it was more of our stamina in the final dying moments of the match, really. And what we saw was the French quality, especially off the bench, but also just that star quality that they have on the pitch to start the game with. You know, players like Penno, who we could have possibly said, well, re-Samit when we had him, had that little bit of stardust to his name too. But that's what we're really lacking at the moment. And we've had players like Cam Winnett come in, you know, who I think has been a revelation in the fullback role, having played, I think, less than 20 professional matches in his career. I think Rio Dyer's improved big time too, especially the way that he's been attacking. Still think that he could improve defensively, but you know, we have got young players in that starting 15 at the moment, and I think once the rest of the players come back who have been injured, your Jack Morgans, Dewey Lakes, Gareth Anskers perhaps, you know, that is when we are going to see a big improvement in this Welsh side.
You spoke about the size of the French pack and the impact it had. I don't know if you guys saw, but Gabby Logan put out a tweet on the weekend about substitutions. Does international rugby need to do something about the replacements? Many games are balanced until the bench is emptied and then the dominant nation prevails. What do you do? Do you limit them, restrict them to a 4-4 split, or just leave it alone as Henry clearly wants to?
Like you have to... There is an argument that there's too many subs and it's too much of an impact. But to say that it's making that much of a difference, isn't that what sports is all about? We've seen with football, there's now, it always used to be three subs, then COVID happened and now it's up to five and it's just stayed there. I just don't see it as being that big of a deal. The big argument, I think, is more that having bigger players creates more of a risk of injury later on in the game. But even then, has there been any studies to actually prove this? If there has been, then that's a different thing. But you can't, on a player safety basis, you can't have anything less than three front rows on the bench. So that's three subs at least. And then you can't not have other forwards on the bench. You can't not have a lock and a back row. And then when it comes to backs, we saw it with Ireland actually, where they were forced to play Jamison Gibson-Park on the wing. I think that's fine in that situation. But if you had a team where if you had a situation where it was a 4-4, where it was, I don't know, even three subs or whatever on the bench, you're going to have that more and more. And then you're going to be stuck in a situation where it goes, oh, well, we lost because we had an injury. And I just think having a full bench as we currently do is probably the best situation. Maybe there's an argument to go down to seven subs, but I just don't see why limiting the number of forwards on the bench is that big of a deal.
Toby, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm split kind of half and half as well. I think Henry does make some good points that actually having these substitutes is part of the game and actually the ability to to have a deep bench and change your tactics is in some ways what makes the best teams the best. Because, and that is harsh for the smaller nations who don't have as big a benches and as big a backroom staff and whatever it might be. But from the other point of view, I think what I think a lot of people want, or sort of some people anyway want, is to, you have this, you still have eight people on the bench or seven people on the bench, whatever it might be. However, you can only bring them on as injury replacements rather than as your sort of your finishers who come on. And someone like Chandler Cunningham himself is an absolute unit. And they're saying with a lot of the French guys, South Africans, they come on and they have 20 minutes of full fitness. They go hell for leather. They just annihilate people for 20 minutes because they're fully fit. And they're doing it against sort of tired guys who maybe aren't as ready and are more likely to get injured. So I think there is perhaps an argument that maybe you allow your three front rows are allowed to change, and then you can make one or two other changes throughout. And you can still have more players on the bench, perhaps, but they're only there for injury replacements, I guess, would be one sort of an argument. So I think it would be interesting to see. I've got a University of Bath PowerPoint up here talking about exactly this. So if you come back to me in a few minutes, I'll see if I can find what their study is saying and whether injuries are being caused by substitutions.
The only thing that I've got against that as well is what is an injury? Who decides that? Because could we, if that became a situation, could we then see more instances of, for example, Bloodgate? And would you then have to have a third doctor, an independent doctor assessing everyone to say, you are thoroughly injured, you've got to come off? I think it would just create more problems and complicate it. Obviously, at grassroots level, when you're playing the level that I play, you're allowed three subs and that's it. And I think it makes sense in that situation where you have one designated front row cover, because then you don't have a team that can only show up with 16 players playing against a team that's got a full bench. And it makes sense in that situation, but international and professional rugby isn't that. You are going to be showing up with a full team. And we all sort of took the mick when Eddie Jones did the whole game changers thing. But it is, and that's part of the tactics. You have players on the bench that aren't just a like-for-like replacement. They're a player that can change the game. It is just become part of the game. And to change that, I think, would almost be to negate the minds of coaches almost.
Will, any thoughts?
Yeah, it's a discussion that comes up again and again and again, especially in recent years. I'm just thinking about the bomb squad, right? South Africa really playing around with the splits on the bench, going from sort of 5-3 splits to 7-1 splits, as we most recently saw in the World Cup. And it is an interesting topic, especially for coaches, I'd imagine, in the way that they want to set up their benches. Of course, we know South Africa do that 7-1 split to really enforce the game through their pack. And we've seen on countless occasions now when they have used that 7-1 split that it does have a real impact off the bench in that forward region, and really allows them to continue that combative game plan that they like to use. But yeah, it's difficult. You don't want fresh players running into tired legs at the best of times, don't you? But especially when it's causing injuries. And that's something that the statisticians, I'm sure, would be able to tell me. I don't have the numbers in front of me here right now. But I mean, without looking at the stats, what I could say is, over the past 20 years, rugby has changed a lot, right? There are more carries nowadays. The game's played at a higher pace. Everything's more regimental in the way that the game's set out. And part of that is linked to the use of substitutes to allow that style of rugby to be played, right?
Well, you mentioned the bomb squad as well, but there's obviously when South Africa have done it with the 7-1 split, it's really worked out for them, but there's no guarantee that's going to work. If they suddenly get a couple of injuries in the backs they're suddenly in a situation where they're playing a flanker in the centres, for example, and it might actually just crumble around them. So it's a level of tactics in the game that I think really sets it apart from other sports as well. It's just something that makes rugby what it is. If you got rid of that, I just think it would change the game in more ways than I think a lot of people necessarily realise.
Fouls too, yeah, them stats.
Yeah, they're not very conclusive. it's not very revolutionary. It's kind of saying there's not actually a massive difference, other than in the injury incidents are basically much higher in starters compared to replacements in the sort of final quarter, which you would expect, but that's just general, I guess, as well. But it doesn't really seem to suggest whether their injuries themselves are actually being caused by... there's one. For injury tackles involving a starter and a replacement, there's a slightly higher risk to injury to a starter and a lower risk to a replacement. Doesn't give any specific numbers, but I think there is definitely cause, but I don't think there's anything revolutionary within it. And there will probably be a lot more studies done on it over the next few years as sort of more sort of studies develop within the sport.
Definitely. I think there is an argument if it was to go down, maybe down to seven, and that would create that real dynamic of, do you have three backs on the bench and four forwards, or would you go five forwards? Because you'd have to have a full front row. So let's move on to next week's fixtures. So it's going to be Super Saturday. We'll start off with Wales versus Italy for the wooden spoon, it seems. How do you think that's going to go, boys?
Well, I'll be watching from behind the sofa, that's for sure. I'm not looking forward to it whatsoever, especially with Italy coming off that famous 31-29, well, I think I'll just go 31-29 victory on the weekend. So, yeah, I'm worried, definitely. I'm not worried about the future of Welsh, the near future of Welsh rugby anyhow. I think it's actually been quite a successful Six Nations in the way that we've rebuilt the squads, but as far as Saturday's game's concerned, yeah, it's going to be a real battle out there, and I'm sure Wales are going to be doing everything within their power to get that first victory of the Six Nations on the board.
Yeah, I agree with Will. I think it's a very, it obviously matters in the fact that you never want a wooden spoon, but I think Wales have been hard done by in a lot of ways. Or in theory cheated themselves out of victories. The fact that they were 1 point down on Scotland, having been, what, 20-odd points down at half-time. England, they only lost in the final few minutes, having led the whole match. And I think it is just those fine margins which Wales will develop over the next few years. And when they actually get a few more sort of senior players back, it's crazy thinking Jack Morgan and Dewey Lake are senior players, considering that they barely played for Wales before 6 months ago. But it's players like that, Talupe Faletau, Anscombe, as Will's mentioned as well, I think could be really, really key just to have a bit more experience in that back line to try and command it and sort of maybe play a bit more how Gatland will want to play with the backs. So I think even if Wales lose, there's not massive panic, or there shouldn't be massive panic within Wales. And I don't think Gatland will be panicked at all by it, because he knows how hard it is. You saw from the Six Nations documentary that came out a few weeks ago about the Six Nations last year, there was minimal panic even when he knew that Wales were in a really poor situation after the last couple of years of poor performances. And so I think unless we get absolutely battered by Italy, which I think is somewhat unlikely just by the way that Wales play, and we've had great performances so far in the tournament, I think there's every likelihood that Wales actually get a victory and leapfrog Italy to finish fifth, which would be not a fantastic achievement, but I think would be well-deserved, possibly. If not, they arguably could finish higher up, or should have finished higher up, had they managed to convert a couple more matches earlier on in the tournament.
I wanted to say as well, how nice has it been to not talk about which team's going to smash Italy this week throughout the Six Nations? It's so refreshing to have six genuinely competitive teams in the Six Nations. You know, it's the Six Nations for a reason, right? And you want all six teams to be competitive against each other. And yeah, we've seen glimpses over the last couple of years that Italy could potentially compete. But I think this year we've really seen a step forwards with the new coach, with Crowley going. Some questioned whether Crowley leaving that role as coach of Italy would have a detrimental effect to their progression. But I think what we've seen is that with Caseda coming in, they've taken that next step forwards. And yeah, arguably, they should definitely have two wins so far, the Six Nations. And yeah, from a personal point of view, I hope they won't get that second victory in the end. But who knows? It's going to be one hell of a battle out there on Saturday, that's for sure.
Do you almost see this period of Welsh rugby? I don't want to compare them too much to England, but there's a lot to be said about a team going through hardship to then come out of it a much better team. Do you almost see the Six Nations as their almost England 2015 World Cup sort of going through a low before they get to a peak?
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't necessarily been that much of a low. You know, it has just been a Six Nations of tight margins from top to bottom. I think that's what we really have seen. And look, we lost by 1 point to Scotland. We lost by 2 points to England without scoring a point in the second half. That's been another problem. Got comprehensively beaten by Ireland and led France until the 65th minute on the weekend. So arguably, yeah, it has been a Six Nations of fine margins. 100% it's been a rebuilding period for Welsh rugby. I think that goes without saying almost, but I think the depth of the squad that's really been challenged, and that has been a difficulty for Gatland during this Six Nations with the youngsters that he has just had to throw there into the deep end. I think we will come out a better side for it in the long run. And honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if we actually challenge next year for the Grand Slam, for the Triple Crown. You know, it's not that far away, I don't think. I think with the return of, you know, half of the starting 15, essentially, we could really see a Welsh 23 that can go out there and compete against the best of the best on their day.
So I'm going to ask all three of you, who's winning? Wales or Italy?
I think you got to back Wales here. It's going to be tough one. It's in Cardiff, I think, which is definitely helpful for Wales. Whether they will be able to convert it is obviously another matter. I think they should be able to, and they definitely have the ability to. They just really need to try and score a few points. And actually, I think really interestingly, it'll be almost Italy sort of will try their attack against Wales's sort of resilient defence. I think will be a really interesting matchup, whether Italy can sort of slice their way through and score a few tries, or whether Wales, who have defended well generally for a lot of the tournament, will be able to hold them out, and can they do it for 80 minutes, which they've struggled to for the tournament.
Ricky, who are you saying?
I want to say Italy. I think Wales are capable of beating Italy at the same time. But if Italy can utilise that tactical kicking game that they did last week, I'm going to back Italy.
And Will, as if I need to guess.
Look, I'm worried, to be honest with you, for Saturday. I think all the pressure's on Wales. Italy have zero pressure on them. They've done what they needed to do with the Six Nations, Italy. They've won a game. And they're going to be coming to Cardiff brimming with confidence after that Scottish victory. Of course, last time out, they managed a win in Cardiff too. So I'm sure there'll be some fond memories of that victory in the squads. So yeah, as I say, all the pressure on Wales. We can't go back-to-back losses against Italy in Cardiff. I really hope we win, honestly. But I think it's going to be a battle from minute one to minute 80. So yeah, I'm hoping that we'll just, what I can see happening is that we'll win the game and Italy will end up in fifth through a losing bonus point, which I just think will be a dagger in the heart. But look, as I say, it's going to be a tight one. I'll go Wales. Wales win.
I'm going to go controversial for my one. I'm not going to level the playing field. I'm not going to say that Italy are going to win this. But what I will say is I think it'll be so close, it might be a draw. it's an outside bet.
He
but...
just had to be that guy.
They've got one draw. What's saying they can't get a second?
So, will it be an equally crazy finish, or will it be sort of 3-3 throughout the whole game? No points scored, nothing happens.
I would love to see that. There was a match actually last weekend. Who was it? Was it Nottingham? Where
Nottingham
they won,
Hartbury.
Nottingham versus 3-0. Hartbury. They won 3-0. I need those highlights. I need to watch that. That sounds like my perfect game. So on to Ireland versus Scotland. Can Ireland claim it? What do you think?
Yeah. They're going to get back to what they are very good at, and that is just fundamentally playing incredible rugby. I think Scotland they've plateaued, haven't they? They've done what they do. They've come in with all this momentum. They played really well, and then they've just absolutely crumbled. And the loss to Italy last week is just going to be like, team morale is going to be an all-time low, isn't it? So I think Ireland will want to get back to winning ways and just crush Scotland, to be honest.
Will, what are you thinking? Ireland or Scotland?
I think both teams are going to have a point to prove after both losses on the weekend. So I do think Ireland will just have too much strength on the day. And of course, a victory for Ireland secures the Six Nations title for them. So, yeah, I think Ireland will just about have enough. I do see a better performance from both sides, nevertheless. And again, I think it will be a real battle between both sides. Because it's in Dublin, right?
It's in Dublin, yeah.
It's in Dublin. So, yeah, I mean, the home crowd are going to carry Ireland home. I won't be surprised if there'll be countless renditions of the Zombie chorusing around the Aviva Stadium come Saturday early evening. So, yeah, I'm going for an Ireland victory on Saturday.
And what about you, Toby?
Yeah, I think one thing people haven't taken into account here is obviously everyone's talking between Ireland and maybe England could take the championship as well. If Scotland beat Italy by 40 points and they don't concede a bonus point, then they could win the whole championship. You can't rule these things out, you know. but I think, yeah, in all seriousness, I think Ireland will win that one as well. I think it was a blip last week, and the way Andy Farrell talked about the loss, I think, gives me a lot of faith that they will be back at their best next week. And we'll probably put in the most efficient, effective Irish performance we're used to. And they will just go line out, maul the ball down the pitch, line out scrums, just demolish Scotland up front, which they comfortably can do. And then they'll spin out and probably a hat trick by some of the backs, maybe Bundiaki will score a couple crashing over or Keenan at fullback or whoever it might be, I think. I think he'll score a couple. He'll be in my fantasy pick when we get to it. Maybe.
What's the score going to be, Toby? 78-0. How many tries are getting scored?
I reckon it'll be. I'm going to go sort of 35 to 15 or something like that.
I think what will be interesting is actually both teams coming into it. Obviously, they're both coming off of losses, which is a strange thing to think at the start of this tournament. But they're both coming into it with very different mentalities. Obviously, they'll both be wanting the win. Ireland will want a win to lift the trophy in Dublin. But they don't need a win. There's not really that pressure on them. They just need a bonus point. And to be able to stay in touching distance, I think, could give Scotland a bit more hope. That being said, I think Ireland do win it just for purely winning it in Dublin to win the championship. What's not to love for them? And finally, we have the big one, hopefully. We have England versus France in France. Ricky, how do you think that one's going to go?
Well, we've seen a France that have suddenly just started to click. And I don't know, it might not matter a single thing after that Ireland game. So it's kind of one of those you... very up in the air. I think England will be motivated to win no matter what, you know, to keep the good, keep a good precedent up. But I don't know. I think France will give them a good game. Hopefully we'll have a Scotland win before to give us something really to be excited about. I'm going England win.
What about you, Will? What are you thinking?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Of course, both teams coming into Saturday off off big wins. But I just think France at home in Paris are just too strong on their day. Yep. And as long as they turn up to even 80% of their quality, I just think they'll have too much up front for England. And look, England are just coming off, you know, one of their best victories since the 2019 semi-final in all reality. So, of course, they're going to be brimming with confidence. And I wouldn't be surprised if England really challenge France and run the game really close. I think it is going to be a very closely fought match. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's only a couple of points separating the two sides at the end of the 80. But yeah, why not France to win with a final minute drop goal just to rub it in the wounds?
What about you, Toby?
Yeah, I agree with Will that I think it'll be a tight game again. I think England might just pip it. I think it'll be interesting to see how they sort of face up after an amazing victory last week, and whether that was almost a high for them and that was what they're aiming for, or whether they'll just build on what they had in the great performance. So I think, again, depends on which France turn up as well. I mean, they've had a few unbelievable games, and they've, as you mentioned, that final 15 minutes against Wales, they just steamrolled us. Whereas if they play if they play the way they did against Italy in that second half, then they'll almost definitely struggle. So I think England will just about take it by probably a few points, probably with Ben Earl carrying millions of balls again as per usual. But I think it will be an interesting game and probably quite a cagey game, I'd say, but with what should be quite an interesting finish, hopefully.
I think it will be interesting actually seeing whether or not the England players actually are even going to be aware of what the score is for the Ireland match, whether they're just going to be told to go into it blind and just excluded from the outside world almost, with the intent of we have to get four tries, we have to get the win, we have to be chasing this Six Nations title. Because if it comes to it and Ireland have already won the tournament, that could seriously shift the attitude of the team. Not that I don't think they'll still be giving everything for it, but I think it could really be something that really disrupts how strongly England can play. I think France are going to be a real struggle. If they can carry on the form that they finished against Wales, it's going to be a real worry. Playing in France, they're going to want to end on a high, but I can't not back England in this situation. England got a chance, as it stands, to somehow get the championship title after what sounded like they were completely out of it after the Scotland match. So I can't say that France are going to beat England. So it's got to be England.
Surprise, surprise. No, it's definitely going to be a classic Super Saturday, I think, isn't it? It's just a great advertisement for rugby. And
my only wish is that they couldn't swap the England and Ireland matches around.
Flipped it. So annoying. Like, it could just be such a deflating 8 p.m. kickoff. Knowing full well that Ireland are battered Scotland or something like that. Anyway, just here's to keep it positive, you know.
So finally onto the fantasy. How's it looked this week? Obviously, I've had a little bit of a comeback. I still haven't quite mastered the art of the super sub and the art of the captain. I selected Alex Dombrandt, and when he nearly crashed over, that had my heart in my mouth. I've already said before to you boys, it could have been so good, but it wasn't quite. Obviously, I'm back up there competing as I wasn't at the start of the tournament. How's it gone for you boys?
I think I'm still languishing down the bottom of the table after missing the first week, unfortunately. But you know, the comeback could be on. All I need is one really good week, and maybe I'll shoot up the table.
All you need is 500 points, and you might get the lead.
Easy. That's when Benno, I'll captain him, and he'll score 73 tries. Simple.
I know it's Cheltenham on this week, but I think it's gonna be a bit of a two horse race between myself and Ricky going into Saturday. I'm just looking here now, and there's 40 points that separate us at the moment. So yeah, it's gonna be a real battle, and I'm hoping that I'll just pip him on the nose.
I'm at a bit of a loss, to be honest, because I remember looking Sunday evening and I was top of that table, and then suddenly it went like that, and now you're 40 points ahead again.
It was really bizarre. There was one point on Sunday after the match where myself, Will, and Ricky were only 2 points separated, and now there's 2 points between myself and Ricky, but somehow Will's just got a load of points out of nowhere, it seems.
Out of the Welsh boys through the stats. So.
That's what happens when you back the Welsh boys.
I did send a message to Ricky, actually, after Saturday, where I was top of the table for round four. I admittedly only had three players playing on Sunday, but I was top.
I saw I finished fifth in the round, and I was like, what is fifth? I'm not really used to being so far down this leaderboard, you know.
Whereas I was ecstatic.
Who are we going to be targeting on Saturday, boys? Which teams?
It's not the classic case of you can target Italy anymore, is it?
Yeah. So you've always got to think.
Difficult challenge.
Because you've almost got to think, if England are in it, you'd have to target an English player that's going to be getting those tries. But at the same time, if they're not, they might not. I think I've got to go for an Irish player this week. I think he managed to bag two tries against England in their loss. It's got to be James Lowe. He's going to go over the whitewash. I think in a match where Ireland's just going to be chasing the lead, I think he could be the one to do it.
I think for me, I'm going back to the roots of Ben Earl. I think he delivers week in, week out. You can't not go for Ben Earl. The weeks I haven't gone for him as well, he's done even better than the weeks I have. I had Bundyaki last week, he did all right, but I think Ben Earl for me has got to be the he's always a point scorer. That's all you need to know.
That's almost the Haaland choice, isn't it? To go with Ben Earl, the way that he's playing at the moment. But yeah, I am going to target Italy. I still think that they are prone to conceding a few tries of their own. So yeah, I'll target one of the Welsh backs, whoever starts on the day. Maybe Josh Adams, I think he's due a couple of tries. Hasn't had his finest Six Nations by any means. But yeah, Josh Adams perhaps can win it. He's made a lot of metres as well, this Six Nations. So yeah. I'm just hoping to keep that lead over Ricky on the final day.
I reckon I'm going to get Ollie Lawrence. I'm feeling some Ollie Lawrence masterclass on Saturday evening. Don't know if this is just being incredibly hopeful or biased or both, but yeah, I'm going Ollie Lawrence.
I completely back that choice. It's strange I haven't gone for an English player. It is also great to see someone selecting a forward, because I do feel like on these choices, so often we pick backs because we just go for those proven try scorers. But I do think Ben Earl he's in for a shout there. I wish I'd captained him this week instead of Lewis Lynah. Maybe I was a little bit too hopeful.
Yeah, you got to push the boat out a little bit this week, being the last week. Well, come on.
I'm chasing that third, well, chase, yeah, chasing that third place.
Yeah, we haven't done anything where the winner gets something as well. It's terrible.
Pride. Satisfaction.
Height.
I'm only 180 points behind Will. I can do it, I reckon.
Good luck, mate.
Thank you very much for listening. This has been The More From Grace. We'll see you next time.